Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A federal judge will decide tomorrow whether reporters Judith Miller of the New York Times and Matthew Cooper of Time Magazine will go to jail for refusing to name their sources, government officials who revealed the name of CIA agent Valerie Plame. The two reporters were working on stories about Plame's husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. He had criticized the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Columnist Robert Novak initially broke the story that outed Plame. That led to a grand jury investigation to find out who broke the law by leaking the top-secret information to reporters. Well, there are now reports that that leak may have been White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove. Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek, writes that Rove was a source in Matthew Cooper's story in Time magazine, but Isikoff stops short of fingering Rove as the person who leaked Plame's name. Another reporter is willing to name Rove. Michael Isikoff joins us on the line. And Michael, how do you know that Rove was a source at all?
The emails and notes that Time magazine turned over late last week to Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald identify Rove as one of reporter Matt Cooper's sources for the story that he wrote that mentioned Valerie Plame as being a CIA official. We further report that Robert Luskin, Karl Rove's lawyer, confirms that indeed Cooper did interview Karl Rove, and he did so late in the week before the Novak column and before the Time story. That is very critical because people have wondered for some time why the focus on Matt Cooper's Time magazine story that came after the Robert Novak column that first outed Valerie Plame. So if, in fact, information was imparted to Cooper about Valerie Plame, simultaneous with it being imparted to Novak, there could have been a double exposure of her name in violation of the law. We don't know it's Rove. We just know that the two of them talked.
Well, what is Mr. Rove's lawyer saying about the possibility that it was Rove?
What he has said, and it's very carefully worded, is that he did not disclose classified information, and he did not tell any reporter that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA.
In fact, his lawyer, I have the quote here, his lawyer says that his client, Karl Rove, never knowingly disclosed classified information. Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC says that he has high-ranking sources within the White House who tell him that, in fact, it was Karl Rove who named Valerie Plame. And he points to that word knowingly as key. Does it jump out for you?
Well, sure. It's certainly a part of the legal vocabulary here that's designed to insulate Karl Rove from criminal charges. But I think you got to look at the other language as well. And I think the real point here, and I don't think this is quite penetrated yet, is that Matt Cooper is scheduled to go to jail on Wednesday for not talking about his confidential sources. We now know that one of those confidential sources is Karl Rove, the deputy White House chief of staff.
Whether or not he named Valerie Plame.
We do know that when Matt Cooper got a personal assurance from Lewis Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, that he had no objection to Cooper talking to investigators about what the two of them talked about, Cooper agreed to do so. There has been no personal assurance given, as far as we know, by Karl Rove to Matt Cooper saying, I have no problem with you talking about what the two of us talked about.
Well, now, wait a minute. We understand that, according to his lawyer, Karl Rove did testify before the grand jury two or three times and signed a waiver authorizing reporters to testify about their conversations with him.
All White House employees were asked and did sign that waiver. The position that Time has taken is that those waivers are meaningless, that no waiver of this kind can provide any assurance to the reporter that it wasn't done under coercion or it's not done as a condition for keeping your job.
Well, that raises another question. If Karl Rove is in fact the one who leaked the name of Valerie Plame, and he testified before a federal grand jury saying that he didn't, Might there be other charges considered?
Oh, yes. Nobody really knows what Patrick Fitzgerald has up his sleeve here, what the nature of the evidence is. But a lot of people have speculated that this can go one of three ways. He could have identified the source who provided Valerie Plame's name and concluded that that source acted in knowing violation of the law, in which case he can bring a case along those lines. He may find that there's no case at all here because nobody who imparted the information was aware of her undercover status and was aware that they were knowingly providing classified information to a reporter. The third option is the one that probably is the most interesting and has been the subject of most speculation in Washington, which is that he has, in the course of investigating this, concluded that somebody provided false statements or perjured themselves to the federal grand jury or sought to obstruct justice and cover up the nature of conversations. And if that's the case, he could bring charges along those lines.
Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Michael, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Pakistan's envoy to Iraq says he escaped an assault on his convoy today. Bahrain's top diplomat in Iraq was injured in another attack. And Egypt's leading envoy is still missing after being kidnapped in Baghdad over the weekend, underscoring Iraq's ongoing insurgency. Well, Pentagon analysts recently took a novel approach in their effort to rebuild Iraq and fight the insurgency. The Pentagon's special research group, DARPA, sponsored a gathering of Pentagon officials at Gettysburg. With them was historian James McPherson, who's written extensively on the American Civil War. During the walking lecture and discussion that followed, the historian and the Pentagon thinkers found themselves comparing post-Civil War America and post-invasion Iraq. Joining us is James McPherson, Professor Emeritus at the Department of History at Princeton. Welcome, Professor.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you know, others have spoken of the Civil War in relation to Iraq, pointing out, for instance, that the South in the U.S. had its own insurgency, the Ku Klux Klan. But you really broaden this thinking for us. Can we start at that gathering at Gettysburg? Was the purpose, you know, to make these comparisons, or did some light bulbs go off?
I think it's more a question of some light bulbs going off. The purpose of the conference was post-conflict reconstruction and transformation, and of course the primary goal of that was to talk about Iraq. But my own specialization, as you said, was the period of Civil War and Reconstruction, and they really wanted me to talk about that, and the comparisons came thick and fast in the discussion session that followed my very brief presentation.
This is, again, about trying to rebuild a society and rather than defeating them militarily. And start us off. What were the problems of the Civil War Reconstruction?
Well, the two principal goals of Reconstruction, which, of course, grew out of the issues of the war, were first to bring the former Confederate states, they defeated Confederate states, back into the United States, back into the Union. And that's really what Reconstruction meant, to reconstruct the Union, which had been temporarily disrupted by secession and by 4 years of bitter and bloody war. This first task turned out not to be that difficult, in considerable part because Southerners realized that they had been crushed, that they had no chance of defying the United States. And some of the most prominent leaders in the South, like Robert E. Lee, James Longstreet, the former Confederate Vice President Alexander Stevens, advised the Southern people to cooperate with their conquerors to rebuild the South. So that goal of Reconstruction worked pretty well.
I want to hold you up there, though, just to flesh out that picture. When Reconstruction first began, did the South vote?
No, they did not vote at first. But it was the second part of this policy that turned out to be the great difficulty, and that was what, at the discussion of the Pentagon thinkers, we called transformation, transforming an entire society, a society that had been previously based on slavery, but now was to be based on free labor. Because the 4 million slaves had been emancipated and slavery had been abolished. And Southern blacks would have equal civil rights, that was mandated by the 14th Amendment, and equal voting rights, and take part in the governance of the Southern states. That provoked hostility and eventually massive resistance by many Southern whites. Some of them accepted it, but many of them resisted it. And as a consequence, you had the rise of what we might legitimately call an insurrection led by organizations like the Ku Klux Klan in Louisiana. They called themselves the White League. In South Carolina, the Red Shirts, and so on. And the South was consumed by violence from the late 1860s until the mid to late 1870s.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because you say in addition to the Ku Klux Klan, a lot of people aren't aware that there were other underground groups, the White Brotherhood, the Knights of the White Camellia.
That's right.
And horrendous violence.
Yeah, nobody knows how many people were killed in these insurrections, but one fairly conservative estimate for Louisiana alone, which was by far the worst state, was that there were about 1,000 people who died in open combat, sometimes between black militia groups that allied with the Reconstruction governments and white paramilitary groups like the Knights of the White Camellia or the White Leagues that resisted it, sometimes by lynching, sometimes by secret assassination. This went on in Louisiana from about 1867 to 1877, and there were hundreds more in other states.
And who were the members of the insurgency? I mean,
it embraced a broad swath of white society in the South. Some members of the old planter class at least publicly professed to be dismayed by this violence, but there's plenty of evidence that secretly many of them condoned it. And many of the members of these paramilitary organizations were Confederate veterans. And in fact, General Nathan Bedford Forrest, who had been one of the highest-ranking Confederate generals, was the so-called wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
It reminds us, as we look towards Iraq, of, let's say, the fusion of the Ba'athists, very powerful men, with jihadists crossing the border, you know, real cross-cultural insurgency in Iraq.
And that's quite true. And in fact, this crossing of borders business was practiced by some of these resistance groups in the South, too. Ku Klux Klan or other members from one state would actually cross the border into another state to carry out their raids.
And in the people themselves, you were speaking of trying to fuse the South with the North. In Iraq, we have the Shiite-Sunni split.
Right. And you can see parallels between what's going on in Iraq and what went on in the South during those years. Sometimes it's tempting to push those parallels too far. But I think another parallel or potential parallel, which I think has the Bush administration worried right now, is that after several years of this, many northern people, eventually I think most northern people, became weary of sustaining this effort to bring about transformation in the South. It required the presence of many thousands of federal troops in the South. And eventually, by the middle 1870s, the northern people said, look, we have an awful lot of problems here at home. We have problems with monetary issues, with labor strikes, with growing industrialism, class conflict in the North, a plague on both of your houses in the South. We're going to pull out and let you solve your problems for yourself. And of course, there's that question about when do we pull out of Iraq, what will happen if we do pull out of Iraq, clearly is a concern right now to the Bush administration.
That's James McPherson, Professor Emeritus at the Department of History at Princeton. He also won a Pulitzer in 1989 for his book Battle Cry of Freedom. When we come back, we'll have more on his comparison of post-war Civil War, post-war Iraq. More coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're hearing from historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author James McPherson, who compares the Reconstruction era in the American South after the Civil War with Iraq today. And, Professor, you've said the insurgency in the South in the U.S. was successful to a degree, in that the North, faced with its own economic problems and frustrated with the violence we were just talking about from groups like the KKK, pulled troops out in 1877. What happened then?
Basically, what happened after that is that these white supremacist groups working through the Democratic Party became the Solid South, Solid Democratic South, and step by step they disfranchised black voters, passed Jim Crow legislation that created a segregated society in the South, and that objective of transformation of the South into a colorblind, biracial democracy turned out in the end to be a failure, and it took another century before the country seriously tried to bring that transformation about.
Right. And the country is still addressing, you know, the aftermath, at least, of some of those issues. We've seen trials, you know, in the last few weeks.
That's quite true.
So are you saying that the North mismanaged the Reconstruction after the Civil War?
One could argue that they mismanaged it, but it's hard for me, and I think hard for other historians, to come up with any kind of alternative scenario that might have worked better.
How about more troops, Union troops?
Well, more troops might have worked better, but clearly that was not going to be sustained by voters in the North. What would have happened, I think, is that if, let's say, the Grant administration, which came in 1869, had sent more troops in the South, the Northern voters would have rebelled against that in the next election, and it would have Reconstruction probably would have come to an end even sooner.
Well, in your reading of the historical record, do we know what the Northern government felt about the management of the Reconstruction?
Well, by the middle 1870s, many Republicans, who of course were the architects of that policy of several years or even a decade earlier, had become themselves disillusioned, convinced that this was just not working, and that the Northern voters just weren't going to support it anymore. And even some of the particular friends of the freed slaves who had been the radical sort of ideological core of this effort to bring about a transformation to a biracial democracy in the South, realized by the middle 1870s that they had been too optimistic, too naive perhaps, about how that transformation could take place. So let me just read to you a brief statement by the executive secretary of the American Missionary Association, which was an abolitionist organization. This secretary said in 1875, "The joy that was felt in the emancipation of the slaves dazzled the imagination and blinded the mind to the immense complications involved in the new order of things." And another prominent journalist in the North for the magazine The Nation, which of course is still going today, Edwin L. Godkin was his name, said in 1876 that Reconstruction turned out to have been a failure because it had undertaken, as he put it, the insane task of making newly emancipated field hands, led by barbers and barkeepers, fancy they knew as much about government and were as capable of administering it as the whites. So I think that was a major factor in Northern weariness, the belief that they had just tried to mold something out of clay that was not yet susceptible of being molded in that direction.
Pulitzer Prize-winning historian James McPherson, who's written extensively on the American Civil War and found himself talking to Pentagon thinkers about the comparison between the post-Civil War Reconstruction and what's happening in Iraq. And I'm just wondering, Professor, what do we take from all of this? You might know that there are columnists on the right, Charles Krauthammer comes to mind, who used the Civil War as an illustration of why the U.S. should stick with it in Iraq. You know, the Ku Klux Klan, the U.S. insurgency was active for, you know, decades. So he and others used the Civil War as an illustration of why the U.S. has to have patience in Iraq. What's your take?
Well, in theory, I think that's true. It did take a long time, and even in the end was frustrated. One could even say that it's taken 140 years in the case of the South, or 100 years at any rate. But I think the problem with that analogy is that just as the Northern electorate would not have the patience to continue supporting this kind of an effort for more than, in the case of Reconstruction, 10 years, and turned against it, that's likely to happen again if it goes on and on for years without any kind of resolution. And in a democratic society, the majority is going to rule, and it may be in theory the thing to do that we need to stay the course, but if the voters turn against that, what are you going to do?
Right. You have no choice. And I'm wondering if the other consideration is, why spend 100 years trying to repair something if you can do it a better way?
If you can do a better way, and of course in the case of American Reconstruction, it was repairing our own society. In the case of Iraq, it's repairing or trying to repair a society 4,000 miles away, in which many Americans are becoming increasingly convinced we don't have that important a stake.
Did the Pentagon thinkers at the end of the night decide that post-war reconstruction in Iraq is doable, not doable, half doable?
I think the prevailing mood was a cautious optimism. But with eyes open to all of the problems that might be involved, and that maybe we can learn something from what happened in the post-Civil War reconstruction. Of course, I had to give some other tours of the Battle of Gettysburg the next couple of days to different groups, and so I was not able to take part in the following 2 days of discussion. So I don't quite know what the mood was at the end of those 2 days of discussion.
No offense, I'm not sure they were going to tell you anyway.
No, they wanted to keep it pretty. This is supposed to be closed to the public, at least partly closed to the public. David Ignatius was there, and they permitted him to write the column.
Well, thank you for allowing us some insight.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Historian James McPherson, he's written extensively on the American Civil War, also a Pulitzer Prize winner for his book, Battle Cry of Freedom. Professor McPherson, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, Live 8 is over, G8 begins. We'll preview this week's meeting in Scotland. Also, after Sandra Day O'Connor, we'll speak to a woman familiar with confirmation hearings, law professor Anita Hill. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A new survey by the National Association of Counties is raising questions about national drug control policy. The majority of county law enforcement officials surveyed say their top concern is not marijuana, it's the synthetic stimulant methamphetamine, or meth. They say fighting abuse of the drug, which is made with common household products, is straining the resources of law enforcement and public health workers in urban and rural areas across the country. Western Skies reporter Stephen Rayer recently visited the community of La Junta, Colorado, in the Arkansas River Valley, one small town on the front lines of the meth war.
The police department in La Junta is a typical small-town law enforcement operation. The city of 7,500 people usually has three or four police officers on duty at a time, and while La Junta isn't crime-free, it's not a hotspot for violent crime either. But like police departments across the country, 5 years ago, officers in La Junta noticed a new trend.
Back in August of 2000, it seems like it's about whenever we really started to see an uprise of this, and some of the officers, including ourselves, started to realize that there's more of that activity going on and then that we didn't really know what we wanted to do with it. We weren't trained in it. There wasn't anything really being offered in our area.
Greg Kirkland is a lieutenant with the police department. The problem he's talking about is crystal methamphetamine. He's in charge of public education and officer training concerning meth use and manufacturing.
Lots of stuff in here just kind of keep us going. Most of the time we're out in the rural area, so we don't necessarily have power, or we've shut power down.
Kirkland proudly gives a tour of the department's trailer of specialized equipment that responds to the one or two meth lab busts that occur each month. Because of the environmental hazards common at meth labs, the trailer is equipped with special safety equipment for officers, cleanup supplies, and evidence collection materials. It's also stocked with toys and kids' clothing for when the police find children inside labs.
I'm not sure exactly how many children we've taken out of labs, but it's been several over the years.
Gary Armitage is an expert in illegal drugs. He's the coordinator of the 16th Judicial District's Drug Task Force, which is run out of the local prosecutor's office. A former police chief, Armitage clearly loves his job. He gets to learn the intricacies of the rural drug world and go after drug dealers. He's also gotten to know the demographics of meth users in the lower Arkansas Valley.
Right now, most of the people I deal with are probably in their 40s and 50s. You know, it's past, I hear people talk about, well, when they were younger, they dabbled a little bit. Well, these people are in their 50s, and it's way beyond dabbling. I mean, they're sick, and they're they'll probably never get their lives straightened out.
Armitage also says that most people who manufacture meth in the area make it for themselves and a few friends, not as a large-scale drug-dealing operation. Even though it's surprisingly easy to make meth, labs run by amateurs produce dangerously impure versions of an already dangerous substance, according to Wade Kendall.
And the thing that distinguishes methamphetamine is that little extra methyl group that comes off of the carbon chain that comes off the number 2 carbon off the benzene ring.
Kendall is the chief pharmacist at the Arkansas Valley Regional Medical Center in Lahana. With all the dangers of meth, one might expect it to generate lots of visits to the emergency room, but Kendall says that's not necessarily the case.
Very rarely you're going to see the overdose come in. If you do, they are really, really bad off at that point. What you normally see is somebody who's done a run of speed, and they get out to the end of it, and it produces sort of a psychosis. They're hearing things that aren't there, they're seeing things that aren't there, they're picking at themselves. Very rarely will that present itself to an ER. Usually the people involved with that person will, if they bring them into an ER, they get them out into a psychiatric setting.
Kendall says he is worried about the prevalence of meth production in the area, but he doesn't see an immediate solution to the problem.
There were several labs around that the police have been picking up and breaking up. You can't stop that. There's stuff in place to prevent or hinder the chemist from doing that. You're allotted X number of tablets of Sudafed. They get by that. There's many ways of getting by that.
Restricting access to meth ingredients, like the over-the-counter cold remedy Sudafed, has been a focus of the law enforcement community during the past 3 to 4 years. These new statutes, known as precursor laws, seem to have had some effect, according to many of the officers in Lahana. Meth lab busts have gone down during recent months, but Gary Armitage of the Drug Task Force echoes the sentiments of many when he says meth users will eventually find a way to get their fix.
I really think that probably the cooking is gonna drop. I mean, I don't think we're going to see as many meth cooks. I think we're going to see the same amount of meth. I mean, the meth users, they're just going to get it a different way because, you know, eventually the precursor laws are going to get better and better enforced, and I think that's going to slow a lot of it down. But at some point in time, they're just going to make connections out of Mexico, and the same people that are bringing the coke in are just going to be bringing the meth in.
Armitage sees increased interdiction as the best way to tackle increased importation, but not everyone agrees with that approach. Even though the problems caused by meth are clear, the best way to respond to those problems is the topic of much debate. After a long day of riding his horse and talking to people, Howard Woolridge enjoys dinner while discussing the failure of the drug war. Woolridge spent 16 years on the job as a police officer in Michigan.
We have unlimited amounts of illegal drugs. Then we have all the crime and corruption and cost of chasing all the drug dealers across America. I would be hard-pressed to find one positive thing to say about the war on drugs because it has made essentially everything worse.
Woolridge says the possibility that precursor laws could lead to an increased flow of meth from Mexico is proof that the United States is losing the war on drugs. But he doesn't want to pass new and tougher laws. He wants to legalize drugs. Woolridge is part of a small but growing organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He's riding his horse from Los Angeles to New York City to bring what he calls a Paul Revere-type message to citizens, lawmakers, and just about anyone else who asks him about his cause. He acknowledges that it's hard for politicians to take a position in favor of legalizing drugs, but he says there are first steps that can be taken now.
They could safely promote a concept, which we have in Texas, of no incarceration for personal amounts. They could also be candid with the public when they speak and let them know the truth, that every drug dealer ever arrested or killed is replaced almost immediately, and that all these get-tough laws over 35 years have had no effect on drug availability.
Woolridge's idea isn't likely to find much support in Lahana. The 16th Judicial District's Gary Armitage says the damage done by drug addicts can only be addressed by getting them off the streets.
I have people comment to me about, well, it's a waste of money to put these people in prison, but most of the ones I deal with, we're paying for them. We're paying for them one way or another, so at least we know where they're at.
But there is a middle path that's gaining some support in the West.
I do understand that if you're a small town in the West and you've got a methamphetamine problem, it's pretty hard to feel a lot of compassion for the methamphetamine user.
Luciana Colonna is the executive director of the Harm Reduction Coalition. His group doesn't have a position on legalization, but they work with drug addicts, substance abuse counselors, and law enforcement to reduce the harm caused by drug use, even if that means doing things like providing addicts with clean needles. While these services do cost money, supporters say harm reduction is cheaper and more effective than the $27,000 a year it takes to put someone in prison in Colorado.
Our report on methamphetamine in rural Colorado was produced by Stephen Rayer. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Last week, we heard about a new home testing kit. We said it allowed expecting parents to find the gender of their baby as early as 5 weeks into a pregnancy. Well, first of all, Sarah Reed of St. Louis, Missouri wrote, "I think the actual term that should have been used is sex. Gender is widely understood to be a cultural, social construct, whereas sex refers to particular organs." Right you are, Sarah, but the makers of the kit have called it the Baby Gender Mentor, and they advertise it as a tool to tell parents the sex of their baby early on so that they can pick out curtains for the nursery and whatnot. Well, we spoke with ethicist Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, who said he feared the test would lead to sex-based abortions. On the positive side, he said that doctor-supervised sex testing does have an important use in finding often fatal illnesses passed by sex-related genes, such as Huntington's, he said. Oops. And understandably irate Ben Wise, associate biology professor at Keene State College in New Hampshire, wrote, "Anyone who knows anything about human genetics knows that gender is not relevant to the inheritance of Huntington's. I certainly hope you find a way to apologize publicly." Well, Arthur Kaplan responds, "So sorry, I just made a stupid mistake. Huntington's is not passed by a sex-linked gene. Muscular dystrophy is." Well, Douglas Vitakovich, a sergeant major in the U.S. Army, wrote after our story on Omar Khadr, the 18-year-old Canadian who's been detained at Guantanamo Bay since he was accused of killing a U.S. soldier in Afghanistan 3 years ago. Sergeant Major Vitakovich writes, "Omar Khadr is a soldier, not a child. At the end of World War II, Germany and Japan used children as soldiers in a last-ditch effort because not enough men remained, and that was deplorable. But Omar Khadr went to Iraq willingly and killed U.S. soldiers. This makes Khadr a soldier, subject to the same punishment he'd get if he were 35. And what would you say if he was a 15-year-old American who'd gone on a high school shooting spree? His lawyer's implication is that because Omar was 15 when he was held by the U.S. Army, he is a child and we are evil. Someone make up their mind as to what is and isn't a child." Well, speaking of children, last week we reported on several countries, including Russia, clamping down on adoptions by foreigners. We also spoke with Annie, a young Bulgarian girl living happily with her American family now, but with vivid memories of terrible rumors she'd heard about American parents. Nancy Greenfield of Pembroke, Massachusetts, has adopted two boys from Russia, and she thought the stories were too negative.
Prospective parents need to be encouraged and not frightened by the prospect of adoption. With few exceptions, international adoption creates good and loving families, and that is the more important story than what I heard on Here and Now today.
But Marcia, who didn't want her last name used, asked us to send this note to Annie. "Annie, you said exactly what I needed to hear. My husband and I are thinking of adoption, and I struggle with it. I wonder if the child will feel secure. You brought tears to my eyes and helped me realize that pursuing adoption can be beneficial to the whole family, even with struggles." And finally, Robin Carpenter of Hanover, New Hampshire, wrote after our interview with songwriter Kenny White, whose new CD is called Symphony in 16 Bars. Robin writes, "The pun embedded in Symphony in 16 Bars was prefigured in a country and western song I remember from my childhood in the 50s. That was way back when country music really was country music. The title was Love Song in 32 Bars. The lyric went something like this. I sang you my love song in 32 bars, but all you did was drink my beer. I told you I loved you in 32 bars, but Set 'em Up Joe was all you could hear." And on she writes to the big finale, which Robin writes out phonetically but declined to come sing for us, so I will. "Empty bottles in the old saloon. Now you can buy your own beer, dear." Well, Robin, we found this version from Johnny Bond and his Red River Valley Boys, Love Song in 32 Bars.
"Silver dollars jingling in my pockets. Them 32 silver dollars took off just like rockets. I told you I love you.
in 32 bars. Now you can buy your own beer, dear.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Mad cow disease, E. coli, dangerous levels of mercury. Americans have grown accustomed to health warnings from the U.S. government, and they're often critical of the government and the food industry when problems with food do occur. But historian James McWilliams says the fault, dear citizens, lies with you. James McWilliams is assistant professor of history at Texas State University in San Marcos and author of the new book, A Revolution in Eating. He says, among many other things, that since the Food and Drug Act of 1906, Americans have come to assume someone else will take care of their food safety. Early Americans knew better. And Professor McWilliams joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's always so fascinating to see how much food played a role in the birth of this country. But let's go right to that point. Did keeping their food source safe make early Americans so self-sufficient? Or was it sort of the other way around? Because they were so self-sufficient, they survived and made their food source safe?
Well, combination of both. I think the safety, relative safety of colonial food came from the fact that they were so involved with producing it, going all the way out into the farms, going out into the stables, looking into the kitchen gardens, and studying the process step by step of how a meal came together led me to really appreciate how intimate these colonists were with their food. And that intimacy created by necessity a focus on safety.
You paint a picture early on in the book of the Cole family preparing a meal. I'm exhausted reading it. Wrestling apples into submission to get something to drink. Slaughtering an animal right in your barn in the back. You know, it took all day.
And these services weren't provided. They were provided by neighbors, perhaps. There would be a kind of rough barter system in place, but you couldn't, especially in the 17th century, take your cattle to the slaughterhouse. This had to be done by farming families, and incredibly identity-shaping process.
Right. Well, and also it was seen by Europeans as very crude. I mean, Americans, early Americans, they're also intimate with their food because they're holding it in their hands.
Exactly. Europe at the time was far more advanced when it came to providing the food. The colonists went to a crude environment, a wilderness that they would have to kind of wrestle into submission. And it took a long time for them to establish retail outlets and for food. So this transition was quite dramatic in terms of the material sophistication of their living conditions.
Well, let's talk about some transitional moments. You talk about how Americans for decades before the Revolution embrace all things English. Then because of their robust economy, they began to afford things English, like a colander.
The colonial economy really did boom after 1740, and it grew at a rate far faster than England. And when colonists had a little extra cash in their pockets, they purchased kitchen equipment. They bought cookbooks. Forks. Yeah, we're talking basic kitchen equipment, a colander, like you said. And they often renovated their kitchens or added on to it and, to an extent, formalized the cooking process. It was always comparatively rough, but all the way up to the American Revolution, you have this cultural impulse among the colonists to be British. And I think this is something that a lot of Americans who are just familiar with the Revolution find surprising.
Well, then comes the American Revolution, and it initiates what you call a culinary declaration of independence. What do you mean?
Well, it's a catchy phrase, but what I'm really trying to
that
helps. But what I'm really trying to say there is that after the American Revolution, the former colonists were faced with the challenge of defining a new culture. Mm-hmm. They were British Americans, now they were Americans. Mm-hmm. How were they going to distinguish a new culture? Food was one way that they could do that. And what's fascinating, and in a lot of ways the most seminal discovery of the book, was all these qualities that they were ashamed of before the American Revolution, the roughness of American food, the simplicity of it, the adaptability, the total lack of pretense. After the American Revolution, faced with this new challenge, former colonists said, hey, these qualities are actually virtues. Mm-hmm. Let's turn them into qualities that were certainly worthy of being proud of.
Frugality, simplicity. Here in New England, they ate the bean and the cod till about 20 years ago, and it just didn't change.
Attitudes changed much faster than the actual material experience of eating. And in a lot of ways, this is a very important quality of American food. As I came to think of American food as something unique, it wasn't a set of ingredients as it is for many other national cuisines. It was defined by a set of attitudes that, again, the attitudes like a lack of pretense. We don't need food to be ceremonial, Americans thought after the American Revolution, because we're too busy. We have to expand west. We have more farms to build. We need to replicate this process. So the attitudes were far more important than the actual ingredients, because there was no way you were going to maintain a standard set of ingredients to define a national cuisine when a nation was growing so quickly, so rapidly.
There's so much more to talk about. I was just astonished to see the fighting over food. I mean, during the revolution, the role that food played, there wasn't a lot of it. And, you know, it was considered patriotic to walk up to a store owner and tell him, you've got to lower your prices. You're charging too much for food and there isn't enough food to go around.
To a very large extent, Americans did, in fact, think about freedom in terms of their food. Not exclusively. I mean, freedom was something, it was an idea that was informed from many, many different angles, but food was part of it. And you saw it in a number of ways. If somebody was price gouging, women who didn't have an official political voice would express their political ideas about freedom, about justice by boycotting this particular baker, for example, or standing in front of his shop and forcing him to lower his prices. Mm. Another example would be homebrewed beer. This was a very, very clear and easy way to express your patriotism during the Revolutionary era. And taverns were brewing homebrewed beer, and they were advertising it as, you know, this is American beer. We're not importing porter from England. We're selling the local stuff made with local ingredients, in many cases made with corn. And so this was a clear way for Americans to express political attitudes through food, kind of like freedom fries maybe today. But, you know, we laugh at that and it seems very simplistic, but it does reflect
the
political
ideology.
Yeah.
How'd you come to write this book?
The topic of food kind of found me. I was in graduate school and I was reading a journal written in 1709 by an English surveyor by the name of John Lawson. And there were several passages that just captivated me with the descriptions of what he was eating. It was so different from what he was used to back in England. But he was eating it. I mean, he was giving it a fair shot, and he was actually coming to enjoy the food.
Like what? Like what?
Well, I'll read a passage of something that he found. This was the final meal of the journey. The journey lasted several weeks, and he called it in his journal, quote, a dish in great fashion among the Indians. Here's how he described it. Two young fawns taken out of the doe's bellies and boiled in the same slimy bags nature had placed them in. And one of the country hares, stewed with the guts in her belly and her skin with the hair on. The fact that this guy was tolerating even this food, of course he had to, and he never criticized it. When I read that, I felt like I had the key to this treasure that had been sitting in front of me for a long time. I knew I wanted to write a general book about early America, but the methods that I was learning in graduate school weren't helping me. They were too esoteric. They were too narrow. I wanted to reach a broader audience with a readable book. And then it just sort of hit me, food. And the next thing I knew, I had a pile of note cards that became the raw material for the book.
And boy, again, that really shatters any romantic notion we had of what the colonists ate, because that sounds just disgusting.
I do not in the entire book mention the word Thanksgiving. And it is because I think the myth of Thanksgiving does promote a notion of early American food that is entirely false, that in many ways I hope my book undermines.
That's right.
Yeah.
Boy, we're talking to James McWilliams, author of the book A Revolution in Eating, How the Quest for Food Shaped America. There is so much more in it. Thank you so much for putting it down for us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hope you weren't eating your lunch during that last part there. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.